The late University of Hawaii law professor John Van Dyke worked on historic and precedent-setting cases throughout his career in the areas of international law, human rights, environmental, and constitutional law, most of them cases with a focus on issues specific to the Asia-Pacific region and to Hawaii. His archive is being made available to the public at the law school this Monday, and we spoke with Sherry Broder, his widow and law partner, about the importance of his work in Hawaii and in this particular part of the world.
That is one of the things that makes this particular archive so important, because of his work both in the Pacific and in Northeast Asia, especially relating to international ocean law issues. When you look at, you know, some of the cases that he worked on in the Pacific, you'll see that it's very important and unique. For instance, he represented the people of Eniwetok and Bikini and their efforts to get compensation from the United States of America for atmospheric nuclear testing. Mm-hmm. And that case was heard in the Court of Claims. He represented the government of Vanuatu at the London Dumping Convention. And at that time, the Pacific nations were working together to try to stop the dumping of nuclear waste at sea. I mean, now we think, wow, would anybody do something crazy like that, dump nuclear waste at sea? But in fact, it was something that, you know, was going on all the time. And so they worked together with the Vanuatu, the Pacific nations, and they formed a coalition with the Swedish and other Scandinavian nations, and were able to get an amendment passed at the London Dumping Convention to stop the dumping of nuclear waste at sea. So I think that's another good example of kind of some of his unique work that he did. He also worked for the legislature in the Commonwealth of the Northern Marianas on land issues, because they're, you know, still associated with the United States. And he was very involved in what they call, does the flag follow the Constitution? So in other words, the U.S. territories that we still have, Guam, CNMI, well, CNMI is not really a territory, but it's still the question applies to them. Puerto Rico, Virgin Islands, do all the protections of the U.S. Constitution apply to them? And one reason he became very interested in that was because here in Hawaii, before we became a state and we were a territory, we were governed by what are called the insular cases. And so now these cases still apply to these territories. And, you know, issue is whether or not they're going to entitle to the full protection of the U.S. Constitution when they are under our flag. Not that many people are interested in the issue if they don't live in those places.
Well, there you have it, and that's where advocacy comes in, right?
Yeah.
And that seems to be a common thread in your work.
Well, yes. My husband and I worked together on many different cases. We represented the people of the Philippines who were tortured and murdered during martial law. Mm-hmm. We became involved in that case because Ferdinand Marcos came here after his overthrow.
Departure.
Departure. Imminent departure. So,
yeah.
Of course, he always said that he was hoodwinked into leaving, but I always thought it was very unfair that he should commit all those human rights abuses and then have President Reagan whisk him off in a U.S. Air Force jet and land him here in our beautiful state. And he gets to, in the beginning, he was living on the ocean in Niue. And
with Pampers boxes full of cash,
yes,
you may recall.
I do recall. So
how do you go about making a case like that, you know, of that kind of vast scope with that number of plaintiffs?
Well, my husband, you know, taught international law and had been interested in, both of us were very interested in human rights issues, and we decided when he came here that we were going to sue him for violations of human rights. So Belinda Aquino, who was teaching in the Department of Philippine Studies at the time, we made contact with her, and she had already been contacted by a family, by Agapita Trajano, whose son had been picked up while he was asking questions of Aimee Marcos. And the next time anyone saw him, he had been tortured and was dead. So we represented her. That's how we got started. And then we joined forces with Robert Swift. He's in a big law firm on the East Coast. And we filed the class action lawsuit here in Hawaii. So in that case, we got to work with Melvin Belli. I don't know if you know who he is.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. Well, now people don't. But in those days, he was the king of torts. And he represented 26 victims who were immigrants and lived in San Francisco. And the ACLU of California represented the founder of the Communist Party of the Philippines, who was had sought asylum in the Netherlands. So it was quite an interesting team, and we had a trifurcated trial in federal court. That means it was divided into three parts. First, we tried liability, then that went up on appeal, then we tried punitive damages, then that went up on appeal, then we tried compensatory damages, and that went up on appeal. But when we did the trial, the jury just loved Melvin Belli. I mean, oh, of course they loved us too. They loved us too. But they, you know, every time Melvin Belli would get up to ask a question or whatever, everybody would sit up straight, even though I personally thought we did a better job than he did. But he was quite a celebrity back in those days.
There is an element of theater to judicial processes.
Yes, and Melvin Belli was great at the theater of it, yeah.
What are the other qualities it takes to pursue a case like that, beside persistence and knowledge of the law?
Well, you know, you have to have as your number one principle, if you think you're doing the right thing, never give up.
Mm-hmm.
And so actually I've worked in that case 35 years, so unfortunately I'm following my own principle. We're still trying to collect in that case. We've collected about $26 million, which we've distributed in the Philippines to the clients. We're very fortunate in the United States that with the kind of judicial system that we do have. And not only did we argue in the case that international law views human rights violations as what we call jus cogens, which is a law that's above and beyond and all nations agree. Mm-hmm. There's no question that a government's not supposed to abuse its citizens.
Torture is wrong.
Torture is wrong. So there's the Declaration on Torture, and you know almost all nations have signed it. There's a few who haven't, like North Korea. But in addition to that, once we filed the case, which it really was a seminal case. There had been really one big case before that called Filortiga, but ours was the first human rights class action. The U.S. Congress passed a law, the Torture Victim Protection Act, and so we were able to use that in the case as well. So other places don't have those kinds of, you know, opportunities. I'm not saying not every place does, but it's more difficult, I think, in other jurisdictions, or can be.
But that's a pretty good example of using the judicial process to make a difference, isn't it?
Yes, it is. Yes,
Attorney
it is.
Sherry Broder is the widow and law partner of the late UH law professor John Van Dyke, whose papers will be available in a public archive on Monday at the law school. You can learn more about him on the Conversations Facebook page.